I've known
come back to order.
Stay with that for a while.
All right, thank you. We are back on the record, and Kurt Hager is the witness being questioned. And at this time, we'll go to Mitchell Armstrong for questioning.
Thank you. Mr. Hager, I'm going to talk to you. I'm not going to talk to you about the PCNN unless I ask otherwise. So I'm just talking to you about the ADPs for purposes of my questions, okay? And Ms. McCartan testified that, I think basically she believes the company believes they're prudent because of the cost savings to customers as a result of these projects. Do you agree?
Yes.
And those cost savings are based on the strategist modeling that's been done, correct?
The strategist models, in addition to the work that we did through the other models to bring in the other items that strategist doesn't necessarily pick up on.
And you've probably heard most of my questions when Ms. McCartan referred them to you. Could you just kind of summarize for me why in the applications it says these are conservative figures?
Well, and again, when we look at some of these other items, such as integration costs, we think we've used very conservative estimates as opposed to current, like, market expectations today. We've used estimates that we think will provide us a little bit of headroom. We know that they're over the current cost today, and so that would be a conservative view. We didn't let our strategist model sell into MISO, which would have been something else that might have raised the value. In other words, we're allowed to buy from MISO, so we make sure that we don't underestimate the costs. But if you had a MISO market that was actually higher cost, we could sell excess energy into MISO and maybe get a higher value, and we didn't take that into account. And then in addition, we think that by using the curtailment estimates that came out of the model, which are significantly higher than what we've seen today, again, is another point that we think is fairly conservative. So I think there's a number of items that when you look at kind of the whole context of resource planning, those would be on the conservative side of the ledger.
What are some of the limitations of the modeling?
Again, I think I went over that for a large degree. One, it won't pick up ramp rate, so that's why we use a study outside of the model. It won't pick up the congestion risk, and so that's why we use, again, ProMod to pick up those things. Those are probably the two largest issues that we have that would be a limitation of strategist, and that's why we actually use other models to go ahead and develop those costs and include those costs in our analysis.
And when you do those, did you run – there's certain assumptions that have to be made for all of the modeling. Is that correct?
Certainly.
And do you – you know, we've got four ADP applications here. Do you use the same assumptions for all four of them, or are there differences between the projects?
Again, they're all the same for all four projects, so the assumptions would be the same.
So at least as far as the modeling goes, nothing was done, for instance, for the between the Courtney project and the Odell project.
Correct.
You were testifying about the anticipated increased costs in the natural gas, and I think you said you went off industry forecasts, and I think you mentioned PIRA. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do you know the historical accuracy of those forecasts?
You know, that's a question that everybody asks is what are the historical accuracy? It's like trying to predict the stock market. They're the best forecasts that are available in the market, but do they predict like the shale play coming in? No. And so I think it's very hard to go back and suggest that you're going to look at the accuracy. Again, what you're really asking somebody to do is forecast the future, and they look at the fundamentals. That's what most of their forecasts are based on. And so you look at fundamental drilling, fundamental demand within the United States, and what the incremental cost is, and that's how they come up with their forecasts. But they certainly do not and cannot predict major shifts, such as when the shale plays came in and some of the other items.
So at least as I understand the application, there's anticipated to be anyway a 3.4% increase in the cost of natural gas over some period of time.
Yes.
And is there is there, do you know if there's like a break-even point where if gas stays the same or only goes up 1% or actually goes down 1% where these projects aren't going to save any money?
Again, the 1.7, the low case, the low gas case, still provided some savings, but it's pretty darn close to break-even.
How is the production tax credit worked into Strategist?
The production tax credit comes into Strategist in two ways. In the purchase power agreements, it's factored into the price that we were bid. So the bidder actually takes into account the production tax credit in their bid. The production tax credit is a 10-year tax credit, basically $22 a megawatt hour, escalating a little bit over time. It gets to $23 to $24. Then you get the tax gross-up benefit of that tax credit. So since it's a tax credit, if you're a 50% tax position, you would get the tax credit plus a gross-up, so it makes $22 go to $33. So that's the tax, first 10 years of a project. Anything that goes into service on time, which would be the end of 15, would get the tax credit for 10 years. They don't look back. It's just you get the first 10 years. In the bids from the developers for purchase power agreements, they calculate that into their price that they offer us. They're responsible. They're at risk for it. They bring that in. When we do our modeling on company-owned projects, we do revenue requirements, and then we put in that tax credit.
And as far as where you're purchasing the power, my understanding that there does that price escalate over time?
The production tax credit does have a small escalation that moves up. Like I said, it started at 22, and I think it jumps to 23 for a couple years, and then it goes to 24. But for the most part, it's in that $22 to $24, and then the tax benefit on top.
How about as far as the cost of the energy for NSP? Is it escalate or is it fixed over time?
Again, that would be part of the trade secret information.
Whether it goes up or not would be?
Yeah, it escalates over time. It escalates over time. What the exact percentage is trade secret.
Am I correct to assume that all of that information from the purchase power agreements and the however the production tax credit would apply would be the actual information being used in the modeling to get at the final number?
That is correct.
How are load forecasts used in the modeling?
The load forecasts, again, are an input to the model. So we put in what our load forecast is, both peak and demand energy. That's what the model attempts to solve to serve. So basically it's a dispatch algorithm, meaning it assigns, if you got a certain load to meet, it assigns certain plants to meet that load based upon economics. Lowest cost first, and then highest cost later. And so it goes through and dispatches the energy resources against that load forecast.
If the load forecast was low, what effect would that have on the estimated cost savings to customers?
Low from the standpoint of energy and capacity, either
you
one.
You need more than you forecasted.
Energy or capacity. We have two, right? A demand, so it's a peak day, and an energy, which is the everyday need.
Why don't you explain to me both of them?
Okay. So from a peak day standpoint, I don't think it would have any impact at all because that would really be a capacity resource. That's what your combustion turbines, combined cycles, coal plants, the firm capacity that you're really counting on, okay? Wind is primarily an energy play, and so it's really displacing other energy based upon economics. So to the extent that your demand was higher the demand, the higher the cost of that incremental piece of energy typically becomes, and therefore when you're displacing it, the more credit you get. So if the demand is lower, you'll have lower cost units available to serve it. As that demand increases, you start running into higher and higher cost units to serve. Therefore, if your forecast was low, you would not be giving it the full credit of what could actually be displaced with more energy need on the system.
And help me, if you can, understand how that would relate to the estimated cost savings to customers as a result of these projects.
So again, if you had too low a load forecast in there, you would be underestimating the potential savings or benefits to customers.
So if it was low, the customers would actually save more. If it was high, they would save less. The forecast.
Correct. If the forecast overestimated it, then you might end up with a little overstatement, just like the opposite of the understatement.
And do you know what load forecast was used as far as, or how that was done as far as modeling this to, I guess, get to the $176 million figure for Courtney, Odell, and Pleasant Valley, and then the $45 million figure for Border Winds?
I believe this was the fall of 12 forecast. Yeah, I believe it was the fall of 12 forecast that we used. We started this process in February, so the spring forecast would have come out right around April. I think it was the fall of 12. If not, it could have been the spring of 13, but one of those two vintages.
Has anything that you're aware of changed within the company's forecast that the numbers might be different now?
Nothing significant that I'm aware of.
Have the load forecasts historically been accurate over time, or do you know?
You know, from what I remember from doing the resource planning, we were probably underestimating the forecasts for a while. Then we went through a period after the 08 stock market crash and the financial debacle where we probably over-forecasted for a while, and it seems like the last couple haven't changed a whole lot. They are substantially lower than they were 3 or 4 years ago, but it seems like they've started to stabilize.
Yes, if you could tell me, overall, you know, looking at these projects, and I understand we're conducting an estimate here, but do you have an opinion on how likely we are to be, you know, close to performing as the strategist model suggests?
Well, I think it really, if you look at the chart, I forget, it's in my rebuttal of the, we talked about a little bit this morning about the displaced energy, where most of the energy comes from. Most of it comes from market and gas, natural gas. So that's really the driver of the savings, is the cost of natural gas, and the driver of market energy for a large degree is also natural gas. So it's really revolves around this issue about what is your natural gas price forecast. I think when we look at our baseline forecast, it's significantly lower than it was in the past. I mean, we're around $3.60 a decatherm today, and it grows up over time, but it's at a much lower point than we were, let's say, 5 years ago when we were forecasting and gas prices were around $8 to $9. So when you look historically, when you're in that $3-$3.50 range, gas prices haven't been below that very often in the last 10 years. And so I think the downside risk of it going lower than what it is today is a lot less than it has been in the past. And so that's what gives me a little bit of comfort. And then when we run the low forecast, which essentially keeps that on a real basis, if you assume inflation's about 1.8%, which is what we do, and you show a 1.7% growth rate of a break-even, so that's essentially saying natural gas prices are flat, that these break-even even under that situation. So I think when you kind of look at the dynamics of where the market, natural gas market's been, where the corrective change with the shale plays have come, and then looking forward, these contracts save customer money even at these low prices. And that's what gives me comfort that we don't expect natural gas prices to trade for 20 years at or below $3. You know, when you think about that, that's kind of unheard of. And that's kind of what these wind projects bring to us, is essentially long-term stable prices at almost historical lows.
And you may have just answered my next question, but if there's other ones besides the price of natural gas, is I'm wondering what are some other, you know, possible circumstances, and I'm not talking about things that might have like a, you know, 0.01% chance of happening, but possible circumstances that maybe, you know, normal market factors or something like that that could impact the potential savings to customers as a result of these projects.
You know, natural gas is the real exposure point. Certainly, you know, would something change in technology that would drastically change and lower the price of energy in the United States? I mean, when you look at the prices of this energy that's coming from these plants, again, it's historical lows. It would almost like be like taking a coal plant cost and suggesting that something will come in and start beating coal out on a routine basis. And I just don't see that happening. So really, natural gas is the key point there. So is there something? There could be a technology change or something. But once these projects get interconnected with MISO, once they guarantee the delivery of them, which they will, the reliability of the operations, most of that is gone. Now, company ownership does have more risk associated with production and O&M. We understand that. I mean, that's the difference between a PPA. You get a longer life project with it, but you take a little more risk. But really, those are the drivers.
The other question I had, and I didn't write it down, so I'm going to try and say it correctly, but there was some discussion that basically, how long will it take for customers to realize these savings you're talking about?
You know, in my testimony, I show that the first 3 years, it's going to be a cost, a small cost. By the time we get to U4, we're actually breaking into savings. And so we're not having to wait 10 years to get these savings. Even though the savings are distributed over 20 to 25 years, the pricing that we have on these projects are going to produce savings in the very, very near-term future. The fact is that these resources come on real quick. You know, they're going to be on the system within less 2 years. Another couple years after that, they'll produce savings. And that's the reasonably low forecast, natural gas forecast that we already have in there. If we get any blip in natural gas prices, these will show savings almost immediately.
And just, I wanted to have one clarification on your testimony when I think Mr. Noel was asking questions. You were talking about large wind farms and small wind farms. Where's kind of the break line between a large wind farm and a small wind farm?
You know, I was talking in the context of, you know, like aggregated metering and things like that. I think of the small stuff as, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10 megawatts, 20 megawatts. When I'm talking about the big utility scale size, I'm talking 100, 200, 300, you know.
So all of the projects we're dealing with here today, you would be considered large wind
farms. Yes.
Okay. And then with that, Mr. Noel had asked you if any of the wind farms had overperformed their projections, and you mentioned the Colorado wind farm.
Yeah, the number of them.
Have any of them underperformed their projections?
Usually what we've found is because they have to go to their lenders, and their lenders look at the contract with us, and that's how they look at the cash flow to see if the project's financeable. There's pressure on the developer to make sure that they don't over-forecast their production because, again, that's what many of the economics are based upon. We have provisions in there, like 85%, that they have to stay within a range. So what our general experience has been is that they over-forecast. I don't know of anything specifically where they under-forecast. Again, what I consider on the large projects, I haven't spent a lot of time looking at the small ones.
To what extent are the contracts dispatchable?
The contracts are not really dispatchable. To the extent that we use curtailment as a tool for dispatchability, they become a little bit dispatchable. What I'm saying there is it's a must-take-all energy contract. Whatever they produce, we take. So to the extent that we want to use it to mitigate ramp events or high wind events, therefore, if we don't have enough flexibility, which would end up in a curtailment, we could actually curtail a wind farm. We're going to pay for it. but it allows the wind farm to become semi-dispatchable at that point in time. And we've been very successful at being able to utilize that tool on the Colorado system. MISO is a little bit different because they spread the energy out, so they haven't used that tool near as much. But to that degree, wind can become dispatchable. But in general, it's not considered a dispatchable resource.
Nothing further.
Mr. Lean, did you have any questions? Thank you. All right, at this time, we'll turn to the commission then, and we'll begin with Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your testimony and your questions and answers to this point. You talked earlier today, but first off, I guess, let me set this up a little bit. What jurisdictions do you operate in as far as you talk about resource planning? Do you do resource planning in Colorado, too, or just North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota?
I do it in our jurisdictions that include New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Dakotas.
So you're familiar with what goes on in Colorado, obviously?
Yes.
Okay, because you were talking this morning about how the wind is performing. You're doing a really good job of calculating wind out there. And I just had prompted me to something I'd stumbled across when I was at NARUC out in Colorado this summer, I think I was out there. And it prompted me a little bit, and there's some numbers that I pulled out from Excel that for the city of Boulder. It talked about a 40% increase in rates from 2000 to 2010, a 34% projected rate from 2010 to 20, and a 34% projected rate from 2020 to 2030. Is that generally accurate from what you know?
I wouldn't agree with the projections. Some of the historical rates have
that's from your site out there.
Yeah, I understand what Boulder has said. That's what Boulder is suggesting.
Okay.
And so that's what the site is. The historical rates, one of the big drivers of our historical rate increase was the Comanche 3 coal plant.
Which was a state policy to shut it down?
No, it was a brand new plant. We built a brand new coal plant just in service, and that required a substantial increase in rates to go ahead and put into rates.
So walk me through then, because I'm reading that a state policy talked about the Front Range coal plants to be shut down, and a Mark STUTZ talked about how that shutting down the coal and replacing with natural gas is, you know, perhaps a big 2% increased cost. So there was a state policy to shut down some coal, but then you still built other coal?
Yeah. We built a brand new 750-megawatt supercritical coal. In addition, we had some older units that were getting close to retirement. And so they had a policy that was developed, which was called the Clean Jobs Act.
Okay.
So it gave us the ability to shut those plants down 2 to 3 years early and to go ahead and replace it with a natural gas combined cycle. When you look at it, we increased overall coal capacity by 750, and then we reduced it by 900.
Okay, so where's this coal plant at in Colorado?
Comanche 3. It's in Pueblo, Colorado.
So the southern end of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So the state, one hand they want you to shut down coal plants, but their hand they're permitting the other ones? It's just the efficiency of the coal in the next one?
It's really the timing of the issue. I mean, we started the permitting of Comanche 3 back in 2004.
Okay.
It was completed in 2010 or 11. The Clean Air, Clean Jobs came in to discuss the continued operation of the Cherokee plant, the Valmont plant, which, again, were approaching 60 years plus in age. And so we agreed to go ahead and shut down those plants and replace them. Similar to what ultimately was done up here with High Bridge and Riverside was, since we had just completed a coal plant, we felt that we could still maintain a decent energy mix by shutting down that old
So have you ever looked at something like was done down in Pueblo in the Midwest region?
Yes.
And that just doesn't pencil out because why?
The cost of a new coal plant today just are not economic.
With or without the CO2?
Without CO2.
What makes it not economic?
The actual capital cost of building a new coal plant. We looked at it, numerous coal plant options in Minnesota. And when you're looking at the cost relative to what wind costs and natural gas costs today, you cannot make a coal plant work economically with the current cost of a new coal plant.
So could you make a 500-megawatt natural gas plant pencil out better than a 500-megawatt coal plant, or is it how do you relate those two?
Yes. a 500 megawatt natural gas plant will be more economic than a 500 megawatt coal plant.
Once again, just the technology you're saying is so much more efficient for gas, or
the coal plant, the capital costs are so much larger for a coal plant. And when you're looking at the fuel difference, you know, typical coal plant might operate around $18 to $25 a megawatt hour for the variable cost and for the coal itself delivered. Natural gas plant on a 7 heat rate, a combined cycle, so that's the efficient, you know, natural gas plant. $3 gas, you're probably also in that same $22 to $25. But the cost of a coal plant is probably going to be three times as much, if not more, than a natural gas plant to build.
Okay. You talked about the hedge against CO2 rules for coal. Why is gas not included in that discussion? There's potential limits on CO2 emissions for natural gas as well. Why is gas exempt from that same debate?
It's not. When I talk about a hedge, it's a hedge for any CO2.
Okay.
So it's natural gas, coal, whatever. So natural gas is half of what
coal is. Is that something that we'll be talking about in one of these future cases, that even though that may include natural gas?
When we look at carbon today, we include both carbon.
Is that in your modeling that you talk about CO2 price, gas with CO2?
Yeah, we would include.
Is that in what you?
Yep. When we do the runs with CO2, it includes carbon on gas also.
Okay. Then I didn't get to. Thanks. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. The what do you think about the city of Boulder wanting to form their own municipality for electricity? That's kind of a bizarre scenario. They push hard to get their green stuff, and then the cost raises because of the green stuff, and now they want their own. I don't understand.
It's my nighttime job. I'm on the Boulder. I am the part of the Boulder team. Very unique situation in Boulder. Boulder, the real issue in Boulder is control. They don't like having to respond to the Public Utilities Commission. They don't like the assumptions that the Public Utilities Commission uses. For instance, in this last case, we started our base case with no carbon, just as in here. Boulder disagrees completely. They don't like decisions being made for them that are influenced by other policymakers. And by forming a municipality, they get out from under the control of the Public Utilities Commission.
So their arguments about cost of smart meters and other things, you don't think that's a valid argument?
We really believe that it is actually going to cost them significantly more money to do a municipality.
I would agree with that. And I just, going on the road a little bit just to set it up, that I think sometimes you have state policies people think are great until they start paying for them. And then they're like, wait a minute, we didn't think it cost that much more. That's what I see in the Boulder from my viewpoint, that I'm concerned maybe developing down the road in Minnesota, which may affect North Dakota ratepayers.
And actually, Boulder's gone just the opposite. They have said, you're going way too slow. And, in fact, we think you should accelerate it. We think you should close down the coal plants. They would prefer to close all coal plants. In fact, they're
– aren't there people in Boulder that are upset about the high cost outside of the city commission?
There's people in Boulder, and I'd say a minority in Boulder right now, that doesn't believe that the city has done an adequate job to really develop a alternative power supply.
Fair enough.
And they're very concerned that they're going to get stuck with a pig and a poke when it's all said and done. And the Boulder City Council is controlled by a very unique group of individuals.
Hence your night job. Okay, I won't waste any more time with that. I just wanted to get that out there because I think there's lessons learned all the way around that what may be happening over there. A couple more for this case, of course. Maybe to educate me a little bit. When you weigh different types of energy generation, how much more credit is given to something like gas where you can fire it up in 10 minutes when you need it as opposed to wind when you can't control it? How big a weighting factor is the availability to dispatch it when you figure out your energy mix?
You know, the dispatchability of a resource really comes into play kind of in this integration versus no integration, right? So we penalize wind because it's not dispatchable because we have to integrate it. And that's kind of where the weighting factor. So, you know, when you look at this, the prices that we used on integration is the compensation for not being flexible, for it being intermittent.
Okay.
And so that's what we try to use to equivalent the two.
Fair enough. The when you talk about when wind comes on the grid, you have to shut down other energy sources if the wind is available. That doesn't include nuclear?
You know, I think what our experience has been so far that MISO has been able to spread the energy need so that the nuclear plants are not affected by cycling and they're able to stay on. And in fact, if you look at, again...
But is that a policy decision? Because you could probably do the same thing with the coal plants, which would be more efficient if they ran at their steady baseload all the time, too.
You know, MISO requires you, before you arbitrarily put restrictions on, to be able to prove that the restrictions are necessary. I think we've demonstrated that the nukes really do operate at a consistent level. Our coal plants do and have cycled for load all the time before. It's just that they're cycling differently now for around wind. But certainly when the load changed, our coal plants actually had to cycle at those times also. And so it's hard to suggest that they can't cycle when they can cycle. And then you're starting to put an arbitrary...
But is that a policy decision by MISO that you never would... You're saying you've never had to cycle? Let me back up here. There has to have been times when there was more wind in the grid and it was just winds and nuke that you probably could have used more wind if you shut down the nukes. But is that a policy decision inside of MISO, or is it just a... How does that come
I think
about?
It's a recognition that the nukes have more involved with trying to manage around ramp
higher risk
than a coal plant does. And the risk is just not to lose, to trip nuclear power, a plant like that, and have to go through the process of bringing it back online is much more catastrophic than it is for a coal plant.
And I would agree with that. Okay. Let's see here. We talk a lot about renewable, and I think I know the answer to this question, but I just want to make sure in the record. Is hydroelectric power considered renewable in Minnesota?
You know, we have special provisions. Hydro is considered renewable, I believe. We have a limitation that we can only have so much count towards the standard because we have to have 25% wind.
I thought it was not considered renewable according to Minnesota at all.
The Manitoba Hydro contract was agreed not to be counted towards that renewable standard.
Okay.
My understanding is that the small Run River hydros that we have, 260 megawatts, do get a count towards that renewable standard.
So, if new hydro came into your system, how would that be counted?
My understanding is new hydro would be counted towards the 5% that we have outside. You know, we have 25% wind.
So there's a cap on it.
Yep, and 5% other for 30% overall. So... The fact is we already are meeting the 5%, so I'm not sure if it has that large a benefit.
There's no way it could be go towards the 30% according
to
the current policy.
Yeah, it probably won't go towards the 25% wind.
25%, yeah. Okay. All righty. Can you walk me through how you break out cost allocation, whether it's a purchase power agreement or whether you would own the facility? You know, if you have a purchase power agreement, there's a part that would go through the fuel clause adjustment. If you own the facility, you own it, so there's going to be different costs that break out different ways. Can you walk me through the different advantages for the company vice of having a power purchase agreement, vice owning it, how you look at those and how those might be billed to the customer?
I'm not a rate geek, so I'm going to do it at a real high level, okay? And I'll give you my understanding. The purchase power agreement would flow through the fuel clause in its entirety.
100%.
100%.
Entirety, okay.
A owned project, there might be a period of time that it is somehow collected through a rider until a rate case or something. I'm not going to talk about that piece. I'll talk about the fact that once you get to that, then the capital associated with that and the operating costs would then go into base rates, okay? And essentially, no cost would go through the fuel clause.
When you decide to resource mix, does it matter to you whether you own it or whether you buy it, purchase power agreement, and as far as your resource planning?
No. I have to be completely neutral to whether it's an owned asset or if it's a PPA. My job is to get the lowest cost product of either type. And so that's what we do is we analyze whether it's a purchase power agreement or a owned project.
Isn't there benefit to the company if they actually own those resources? Because then it could be something that they could actually make investments on and get credit for that as well?
There is certainly an earnings opportunity associated with that. But in the world that I live in, I have to be agnostic to which way that looks, you know, which way we look at both types of projects.
Okay. I don't know if there's someone that maybe we'll see what we're all done, but I'd like to explore a little bit how the costs would flow back and forth differently and getting back to the fuel clause adjustment. Because where I'm, one of the things I hope to get out of this case or maybe the next one is that right now we've got a scenario where we're not letting you collect that $85,000 that you talked about in your testimony. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, it's not as simple as just saying, let's say we go to the, we say, no, you can't have that rate. But there's something in North Dakota law called used and useful that my understanding is that there, North Dakota has, is benefiting from the power coming out of that wind farm right now.
Correct.
For free. So they are. We're not paying anything for it. So, but there's a benefit that North Dakota customers have for this wind farm, whether we like it or not. And so that's one of the things that gets challenging with the fuel clause adjustment, that even if we wouldn't approve a wind farm, you still choose to put it in the grid. North Dakota still is benefiting from that. And that's what the use and useful clause. Maybe Mitch and I will talk through that a little bit on break. But mm-hmm. are you at all comfortable talking about how the costs how a person could recoup costs on something, even if it wasn't, if we don't approve it, there still may be an angle that you're entitled to some payment on it. I just see a setup coming for a court decision.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't want to opine on what,
okay.
you know, different mechanisms for recovery.
Okay, fair enough. I think that's almost it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Commissioner Kalk. Commissioner Crispin?
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to go back to that Colorado sample you cited, the area that's sort of its own service area. What were the statistics you mentioned of their power use or needs and how much of it is provided by wind power?
2,200 megawatts of wind. Are currently on the system. We're going up to 2,600, 2,650. And right now it's a 6,500 megawatt system. In comparison, Minnesota is 9,500 megawatt system, so it's about a third larger. Overall, Colorado, just to give you an idea, overall, Colorado, on an that's a capacity basis. On an energy basis, Colorado would be 30% wind.
Okay.
On an energy basis. Then
what is the base load there? What's the mix? What's the other two-thirds of it?
Right now, the energy mix is about 55% coal, approximately 30%. Wind or so will be in about 15 to 20% natural gas right in there. So the coal's moving around a little bit. But that's still heavily coal.
Is there anything else unique about that area? Is there some big number of irrigation systems or something like that that you can have shut off when if you're short and...
No, actually, the only unique thing about that is primarily a residential community. We really don't have any industry. You know, for instance, up here, I think the load control, the load curtailment is roughly about 1,000 megawatts. In Colorado, I think it's about 200 because we just don't have any industry there. The one industry that does exist is a oil and steel down in Pueblo, which has a arc furnace, which is a big load. It's like 100 megawatts. That moves on and off. But for the most part, it's pretty much just a residential-type community load.
It seems, it just doesn't seem possible to me that you can have an enclosed system with 55% coal and a third wind, and that when the wind isn't blowing, that coal is going to be adequate. And the little bit of natural gas that you have as well is still going to be adequate. So I presume then you're bringing in a lot of power from MISO or somewhere on those instances.
Let me see if I can help out a little bit. We have a capacity issue and an energy issue. on a capacity basis, we have half of a natural gas, okay? Because the wind isn't a capacity resource. So you probably have half natural gas, about half coal. On an energy basis, the gas doesn't run very much.
Okay.
The coal does. How we design a system, we design for capacity and energy. Capacity comes first. So in other words, we make sure we have iron in the ground to meet peak day. Just like what we're looking at as the CTs in Minnesota, we just did the same resource plan in Colorado. We picked 400 megawatts of gas-fired resources. The question then becomes, once your system's set up to handle operations, the question becomes, do you run natural gas or do you run wind? It becomes a fuel issue. It's all it is a fuel displacement issue. And when we look at it and said, just like we did in Colorado, we proposed 450 megawatts of wind, we said, our system's set up to run, to manage, to hit peak day, to hit every day of the year we need to with our resources. But the question is, do I run wind or gas? And in Colorado, just like here and just like Texas, we've elected to say we can buy a fuel substitute in the form of wind at a lower price than we can buy natural gas. Okay. So we've got full coverage on reliability. It's just a matter of which fuel we burn.
Okay, I think I've got it, and I'll come back to it in a little bit here. This next one, I actually think you might have given the answer, but I was making a different note when I all of a sudden realized you were in the middle of it. But you talked about a large frame combustion unit can be up and running in 10 minutes.
10 to 15 minutes, uh-huh.
That's not what I've heard from some of our large frame combustion unit operators. So what combustion unit are you talking about there?
Typical GE Siemens comes with a quick start package that allows it to be up and running in 10 to 15 minutes. And that's typically what we buy to put in. So if it's an older style unit, they may
You're talking about a natural gas unit.
Yep. Natural gas combustion turbine. Siemens and GE are the two biggest vendors. Their frame machines, anywhere from 140 megawatts to 205 megawatts.
But to be clear, we're talking now about peaking units. We're not talking about baseload units that can cycle up and down like that.
Peaking. CTs, combustion turbines.
Okay. You've mentioned a couple times in the world you live in.
Mm-hmm.
In the world you live in, what's long-term and what's short-term?
Long-term? Really, in my world, is 20 years plus. Short term is less than that. And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but realizing we're making decisions today for resources that will be constructed and put in service in 2018-19. We're going to start another resource planning process for NSP that will look at 2020, 21, 22.
And do you discuss or think about 40 years or 60 years or 100 years? What's the end of it or as far as long term?
Certainly do. And as we as you discussed with Laura this morning, energy mix, diversity, all of those things come into play in our long-term discussions about what is the world going to look like in 20 years, 40 years, 60 years, when the nukes retire, when the Manitoba Hydro contract that doesn't even renew for another 3 years expires again. We look at all of those things, and we're very concerned about making sure that we maintain a mix that is stable price and fuel. You know,
and so then in that real long-term discussion, notwithstanding the EPA decision that came out a couple of weeks ago that I think probably at this point my understanding of it would mean you can license a coal plant and do one anyway. But up till then, I assume you would have had the same opinion as you expressed to Commissioner Kalk that a coal plant would just be unaffordable. But isn't everything affordable at some cost? And at 60 years out, when all these coal plants are probably going to be worn out and shot, hadn't we better have some, or are we going to just slowly, always incrementally find a way to add a little bit more wind, and we can back it up with a little bit more of something off of MISO, and get to the point where in 60 years, these little trick-or-treaters that are going to be coming around here in an hour or two are going to not have power when the wind doesn't blow.
And we do. We spend a lot of time discussing exactly what are the alternatives that could come up. Do we get cleaner coal technology, which they're working on? Do we get other technologies that could be permitted? What happens with solar? I mean, to give you an idea, the solar prices we saw in Colorado to be constructed in the next couple of years are cheaper than coal plants. Now, is that technology going to continue? What does it look like without it being subsidized? These are all of the questions that we go round and round, not only at our executive level, but with our board of director level. They have exactly the same questions you have. How do you maintain a diverse mix past the retirement of some of these plants? And that's why we're managing. That's why we spent money on IGCC technology to see if it would pan out. We're looking at where will solar actually go. We spend a lot of time and resources actually modeling and discussing different futures and outcomes. But again, one of the key drivers that we respond to our board of directors all of the time is that a diverse energy mix has to be maintained. And that's why when we look at wind relative to natural gas, we don't want to get natural gas sliced too large. We all got a memory of what it was 5 years ago, when natural gas prices spiked up again to that high price. And so what we're trying to find a way is to hedge that price risk for our customers, but to do it when prices are low, not when they're high. And that's really what the opportunity that's in front of us. This wind is priced historically low. This is the time you want to hedge your price risk. And I think we're just fortunate enough, and again, we really didn't have plans to go out and acquire more wind. Going into 2013, we thought we were done in all of our jurisdictions.
Yeah, we've covered that. The question I asked Ms. McCartan about earlier about the 2,200 gigawatt hours per year of fossil fuel power being displaced, does that seem logical to you that loss of sales for the fossil fuel industry, whether it be gas or coal, but in general, is going to drive up their costs for the power that they do sell?
In our model, we've already assumed that those costs are all there. So what we only give credit for is the variable cost. We don't give credit for the all-in cost.
And how does your model evaluate how much it's going to increase their costs?
Again, we take all of the fixed costs that they have, and we spread that essentially over fewer units. So on a per unit basis, it's higher cost. But the fact is our model includes all of the costs. And since we're doing delta cases, and since we only give a credit for the coal not burned, the fact is that we've included all of those costs and it still saves money. It wouldn't be fair, obviously, to say, well, you got to go recover those dollars from somebody else. We understand in our model that we're recovering all of the dollars with that plant, whether it operates at 75% or 90%.
Do you buy power from Basin Electric?
Do we buy power from Basin Electric?
Yeah.
Typically not, unless they're selling into MISO.
Okay. You said this is displacing more gas than coal?
Yes.
And this gets back then to what we were talking about earlier in that first question. But so when the wind is at its calmest, seems often to be those real cold or real hot days. And so on the other days when the wind is blowing well, it would seem like that's not when the gas peakers are on. So it seemed to me that when the wind blows well is when using it would displace coal. So I have a hard time coming to grips with it. This displaces more gas than coal, and I noticed that the Minnesota Chamber had the same concerns.
Well, that's exactly why we model it, is so that we get an expectation of exactly what would be displaced. I believe in Wishart's direct testimony.
Three.
This is actually the case that the 600 megawatts of wind, and you could see the long dashed line, the crosshatched line, is the coal displaced. And the reason we do the modeling is so we don't have to guess. Because we let, the model is very sophisticated, so we let the model be the adding machine, dispatch the system, and be able to give us a model to say what's going to be impacted by the wind shape, which has wind blowing at night, wind blowing through the day. It puts a shape in there to replicate what we expect that wind to blow. And that's because it's too complicated of an issue to try to do it without a model, because you have to have the model be able to dispatch every layer of the fleet. And these are the results that show that the dark line in the middle there, the dark hatch line, is the coal. And you can see it starts out more. It's above natural gas at the bottom. And you can see as you grow over time that natural gas becomes more and more the predominant player dispatched. In addition, the market, energy, which is the short dash line above, is also primarily natural gas.
Have you ever in your years, not referring to this one specifically, but over the years, have you ever had anything modeled where you just decided it just defied logic and dug in and found that maybe the model was wrong?
I do that routinely. not that it's the model's wrong, but that I'm usually wrong. And that when I'm looking at it, I'm thinking that it has one interaction. In reality, when I look at it, the interaction that it's capturing is the correct interaction. So one of the things that I do, I guess one of the traits that I have from a management style, is making sure that I can do this on the back of the envelope and see if it's also reasonably close. And so that's what I typically do, is say, okay, if I look at how much energy is being displaced, does it make sense that it comes up with about the same amount of savings or costs?
Okay. Now, with MISO, provides the wind prediction ahead of the higher marginally priced generation, is the way I wrote down the quote, right?
I'm sorry, what?
MISO provides wind production to the dispatches that ahead of higher marginally priced generation, such as coal and oil.
Correct. Wind is kind of the bottom of the stack.
Okay, so when they're figuring the price, do they calculate in the increased baseload costs that you had talked about, that you've calculated into your mix?
And again, at this point in time, they would only be dispatching on variable. They do not, in their models, calculate anything to do with the fixed costs. They assume that's already there.
Not construction costs, not taxpayer subsidies, not the additional MISO transmission upgrades that you would have to do to add more wind, nope. None of that.
They're just dispatching on a variable basis. So they're calculating on a marginal base, right, for the next hour, what's the cheapest resource. They have to assume that the capacity cost, not the energy, but the capacity side, the cost to build the plant, the cost to build the wires, is already there. They leave your analysis that you talked about to us. That's what this is about. Because once they're talking about dispatching it in real time, it's already built. It's already constructed. That decision was made.
they can't do anything about that decision anymore. They can only make the decision on which plant do they run the next hour. So obviously it doesn't make sense to include fixed costs if that's a sunk decision.
Well, certainly, I would disagree about whether it necessarily makes sense. I mean, when you only look at part of costs, you keep shifting the costs towards the ones that you're disfavoring and away from the ones that you're favoring. So I just disagree with you on that point. Tell me about renewable energy credits. And where do they come from? How do you calculate them? How do you get them? Who do you sell them to, and who benefits from it?
Basically, a renewable energy credit is the currency that's developed when you have a megawatt hour of clean energy. And so there are different organizations like EMRETS and so forth that are agencies that are set up to go ahead and essentially validate a renewable energy credit.
Okay.
And a renewable energy credit you can think of as just a piece of paper. And it says, for every hour of clean energy I produce, I get a credit. And I use those credits to meet my renewable portfolio standard. So I have to turn in so many credits a year based upon whatever my standard is times the amount of energy. So in doing so, I have the opportunity to go out and generate those credits through my own renewable energy purchases or ownership, or I could go out and buy those credits. And the states all have rules of whether you can, what you can buy and how you can buy them and who you can buy them from. Each state's different. But that's the currency that we pay for when we go for compliance. That's why we're allowed to bank. So when we go out and overgenerate renewable energy above and beyond the standard, we get to keep those pieces of paper and we use it for future compliance down the road.
And who sets that in North Dakota?
It would be part of your RPS standard.
We don't have it.
So you don't have to have any for operating in North Dakota, do you?
Well, again, that's how we would, I assume, meet the 10% standard, is to show that we would retire those RECs associated with that standard.
Okay, and then what you don't need, you are able to sell on a market?
And we have sold North Dakota RECs.
And so where does that money go then?
That goes back to the customers. I think it goes to the fuel clause. But
and do North Dakota customers benefit more than Minnesota customers by your credit sales, because their government isn't requiring you to use as much as Minnesota government is, so you have more of them to sell thanks to our regime than Minnesota's regime?
To the extent that we sell, RECs are allocated to each jurisdiction based upon the amount of energy, renewable energy. So whatever percentage of that renewable energy that creates RECs, those RECs are then allocated to North Dakota. When we made the sale, we sold only North Dakota RECs, and all of the benefit goes back to North Dakota customers.
Okay. In 2012, did the Renewable Energy Foundation in the United Kingdom issue a study that indicated, and I'm going to quote, an unambiguous and statistically significant decline in operating performance of wind farms as they grow older?
I have not seen that study.
Is the technology on these wind farms significantly different than Prairie Rose?
I don't know what technology that they're talking about.
No.
Oh,
the wind farms that we're talking about today.
No. I would say the technology, it's the same vintage of technology.
Okay, I asked this earlier and didn't really understand the answer, so I'll let you try again. If by not approving Prairie Rose, North Dakota consumers have saved over $1 million in 6 months, why would I think that North Dakota consumers are going to benefit financially by approving these wind farms?
Well, again, I guess that's where we differ a little bit. I think they've saved about $85,000, not the $1.2 million. Again, because of the way the fuel clause works, they really only have saved about $82,000 or $85,000 by not having Prairie Rose included in the wind or in the fuel clause in North Dakota. So I guess the question is, these are lower priced than Prairie Rose. And if that's an indication, if your $82,000 or $85,000 is the savings and these are significantly less than Prairie Rose, then I think you would see that they're actually going to be in the money and provide the savings that we've suggested.
Okay, I see the $85,000 part here too now. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Chrisman. Commissioner Fedorchik?
Just to kind of wrap things up on that Prairie Rose since we left off there. So if I'm understanding this, because we talked a little bit about this with Commissioner Kalk as well, it isn't that the company isn't – North Dakotans aren't getting – energy from Prairie Rose for free. We are paying for something else instead of Prairie Rose.
Correct.
And that is less than what we would have been paying if it had been Prairie Rose.
Correct.
And that difference is $85,000 or whatever that is.
Correct.
Okay. And so your explanation to Commissioner Chrisman is that why Prairie Rose is different from this is that those costs were considerably higher. Can you give us I realize you probably can't tell us trade secret exactly what the price difference was, but what general percentage difference? Because it is sort of counterintuitive to listen all day about all the money that's going to be saved and then look at one that we didn't do and it actually was the opposite and our customers saved money by not being part of that Prairie Rose project. So about percentage, any indication you can give us about how much less expensive these current projects are?
If I remember from all the information from the Prairie Rose, I believe we're in the 10 to 20% lower range.
Okay. Okay. I really don't even know where to begin because there's so much I'd like to talk to you about, but this has been extremely informative so far. Let me just okay, let's just start here. So do you see any risks to customers? The company has stated you don't really need this energy right now. Is there any risks if you're talking to your friends at a cocktail party outside of this hearing? And being perfectly frank, are there any risks for customers to overbuilding, buying more than what you need?
So you really heard me at a cocktail party.
I would assume you talk about these things at cocktail parties.
There is always risk. Whenever you're making a long-term decision, there is always risk. So I'm not going to say that there's not risk.
Mm-hmm.
But as I explained, when you look at the pricing equivalency of what this wind is compared to what generation costs from all sorts of different sources, from what our generation costs have been historically, and where natural gas prices, which is the marginal fuel in the United States, mm-hmm. is today and is expected to go, these wind projects save money. Now, will it materialize that way? You know, I can't say with certainty. But I'm a lot more comfortable signing a contract at this level, and that's why I pushed inside the company to go as large as we did. Because when I look at the comparison of this price to where we have been historically and where wind has been, this is at historical lows.
Mm-hmm.
Customers will not complain
about paying these prices for 20 or 25 years. Because if prices are lower than this, in real terms, when you look out, energy is almost free.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, it really becomes to that. These are locked in. These are so low prices that I can't imagine that this is what's going to be an issue. Okay. So that's what gives me comfort. But is it for certain? No. But that's why this is unique. Again, we weren't going into it with the idea that we were going to buy more wind this year. Mm-hmm. But when we saw the prices, and we did it across all of our footprints, 750 megawatts in Texas, they don't need it for compliance, 450 in Colorado, 750 up here. The same reason, economics. This is a low-cost bargain for customers, and it's going to keep that low cost for 20 or 25 years.
Okay, then that brings up the question of that our staff has asked. I want to ask it again in terms of integrating all of this onto the system. Because that's a lot of energy, new energy. What are the risks there? What are the hurdles, the challenges, the potential problems of bringing all this wind online in the next 2 years?
I think the biggest challenge, one, MISO goes through a very regimented process to make sure that they can interconnect it, that they can flow the energy, and that it'll flow reliably. That's their main challenge. That's what they do for a business. And that's why they make them go through years of study to make sure that they get it right. So I have a lot of comfort that MISO is going to do their job to make sure that it'll be able to flow on the transmission system and that they're going to be comfortable in the commitments they make to allow it to flow.
So when they sign the interconnection agreement, that work is done. That's the signal that MISO feels this can be done and we don't need to worry about it.
And so they have a very regimented process. And then beyond that, again, I've got experience directly with another jurisdiction that we operate at a higher percentage level of wind. We know how to do that. We've done it very well there. We've made it very economic for our customers in Colorado. We look at the same issue at SPP down at Texas in that area. So we have experience broad across the United States in the wind areas of exactly knowing what resources are necessary. The things that I would expect to see if things were going wrong is that ancillary service costs would go up dramatically. Right now, they're rock bottom. Like I said, they're about $1 million for ancillary services. They're just nothing. The people are becoming more sophisticated. Our company is more sophisticated. We understand what we call having a flex reserve. Typically, in the way they operate, they have an operating reserve, which means they've got to cover their largest contingency.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have now what they call flex reserves. They identify resources that can respond within 15 minutes. They hold so much held back in flex reserves so they can handle these wind events. People, again, are becoming much more sophisticated at being able to operate their systems, know their requirements, know how to plan for it. And that's sweeping across all of the areas. MISO is a huge footprint. The nice thing about MISO and SPP and other organized markets is you can spread that impact to a broad market.
Mm-hmm.
They understand that. They understand what risks they have. So I think all of those things together give me a lot of comfort that they can integrate this. If you look at the MISO studies, as I put in my rebuttal, they're planning on quadrupling. Their plans assume that we will quadruple, not us, but their whole footprint, the amount of wind energy. They're already starting to plan for what happens in those events.
Okay. You talked some about the, let's see here, I'm going to look back, the energy mix in Colorado. So 30% from wind, 50% from coal, and 15-20% from gas of energy use versus the capacity, which you described as half coal, half gas, because you don't count wind for capacity.
Correct. Very
small.
Do you
count it at all?
Yeah.
A little bit.
12%.
Okay. So in Laura testified earlier that in Minnesota, the you're at about 13% energy from wind. Mm-hmm. In Minnesota, and that needs to jump up to 30%.
Ultimately,
but soon, 7 years.
23 is when we start, we think we cross over based upon current projections, again, rack currency and how we meet standard. So you won't get automatically the 25% wind energy.
So that suggests that we have a lot more wind to build for your system to meet that level. Is that a correct assumption?
Essentially 800 megawatts or more.
So if you were to say we're X percentage there, what would that percent be to what you guys meeting what you need to
about
meet that?
70%.
Over 70%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, again, the banking and the ability.
But the banking. But once the banking is gone, then you can't bank anymore once the banking's gone. So how are you going to replace all that banked credits?
The new wind generates at a much higher capacity factor. So when you look at the old wind, it might have been around 30, 32%, 33%. Some of these new wind projects, the two we have, are, you know, in the 45% range. So you don't need as many megawatts to get more energy. So you got to kind of take into account that the technology is changing, it's advancing, and that the per megawatt of generation gives you a lot more bang for your buck.
Okay, give me one second here. When you were talking to Commissioner Christman about this, and something new I learned, so you're selling North Dakota's, you're selling the renewable energy credits that you earn in North Dakota.
Correct.
And all of that goes, all of the money you generate goes, is deducted from the fuel cost rider for North Dakota ratepayers.
That is my understanding. I think there's, I don't know if there's been a 10% sharing mechanism or something like that, but with the company. But the rest of it goes back directly all to North Dakota customers.
All right. Okay, talk to me a bit. You've hit on this, so you probably don't need to speak real long, but give me the reassurance that these kinds of intermittent products aren't threatening baseload. What do you guys do? What kind of investments and calculations, et cetera, do you guys have to make to assure that you've got the baseload and that this is just, you know, to reduce costs? These aren't threatening, because sometimes you throw out things like we looked at wind and coal, and that doesn't make sense to me because coal is baseload and wind is intermittent. So how can you be considering them for the same thing?
Wind will displace coal, just like on the chart that we were just talking about. You know, there is a certain amount of coal energy that will be displaced. So coal plants will cycle down during times of high wind events, potentially. So I'm not suggesting that coal is not impacted. What I'm saying is that since we've included all of the fixed costs of that coal plant and only given the wind study, the wind alternative, just the marginal cost of not burning the coal fuel, we have accounted for the fact that that coal plant on a per unit basis is a higher cost.
Right, I get the cost thing. I'm going way down. Like, think about talking to somebody on the street who is worried that you're putting all these wind resources in, and wind, you can't count on wind. So how is this not jeopardizing the stuff that you can count on? So just an elementary explanation.
Because, again, when we build a system, we make sure that we have enough iron in the ground, resources that we can control, coal and gas, CTs, CCs, that we can meet the demand.
Okay.
It really then becomes just a fuel play.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cover that. Okay, so on the couple questions from the staff's testimony. There's this graph with the negative pricing of wind, and you talked a little bit about this, how you didn't think hours was the way to look at it, but talk to me a little bit about negative pricing. What's the impact to the company? What's the impact on customers? What's the impact to the system on this kind of negative pricing? How do we avoid it?
Negative pricing really comes in the fact that you have to almost pay people to take your energy.
Mm-hmm.
And what that happens is under events, that have, let's say, high wind, we have to put in, when we bid to MISO, we have to put in a price of which we would then curtail the wind. And because of the economics of the production tax credit, we will actually pay somebody to take wind up until the point where the economics would flip up beyond that tax credit. So in other words, if I have to pay Geronimo for everything, all the wind that they produce,
mm-hmm.
and they're getting a production tax credit for that first 10 years, if I tell them not to produce, I've got to make up that production tax credit payment because they lose it from the government.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to take energy and pay somebody else to take it until my cost in the negative LNP world gets down to the point equal to that production tax credit. Now, as we transition over time, some of those original wind farms that were having production tax credits for the first 10 years are no longer going to have production tax credits.
Mm.
So now I will no longer be willing to pay as deep a penalty as a negative LNP to have somebody take it because my alternative is not as negative. And so as we get further in time and more of the wind farms get off their production tax credit the first 10 years, this negative LNP market is going to start to shift around.
What's the impact of that negative LNP market on
it's customers, a cost that's,
the company, the system? What are the impacts of that?
Essentially, I'm paying somebody to take my energy.
Right.
Instead of selling it to them. So it's a cost.
Does it affect the other fuels at all? Does it affect the other people in the market?
It lowers when you get at certain nodes on the system. Again, because if you think of this as a big wiring diagram that MISO runs,
mm-hmm.
you have injection nodes and you have market nodes. And they look at the paths between them. And when the paths aren't large enough, a generation node can become negative.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that you look at because you can't move that energy to a far enough market away. And that's why you get negative LNPs. I think that'll start to change, as I said, because of the tax credit situation. But when we look at that, it's just a representation of market value of energy. Does it have an impact? If you had a coal generator there, they would be getting the same LNP number. The question is, would you want the coal to pay that difference? No. The coal would probably back off. So can it impact others? Certainly, because they're all trying to compete for that energy. And that's why we show coal being backed off and displaced, because that's exactly what will happen. So that's what our models
mm-hmm.
actually simulate, and that's what MISO does in real practice.
When does that usually take place? Like what time during the day is that negative pricing?
Typically at night during shoulder months when there's just not enough load. Thankfully, that's when also most of the coal plant outages occur.
Mm.
So it tends to fit reasonably nice that you have these shoulder, spring, fall months, wind blows, nighttime. But that's when we're doing coal maintenance.
Okay. All righty. Wanted to talk briefly about the chamber comments. And you've talked a lot about the strategist modeling, so you might just need to just summarize here. Or you can say I've already covered it if you don't have anything new. But the strategist, they say in their testimony, the strategist modeling analysis used by Excel and the department lacks the rigor and robustness necessary to justify approval of intermittent resources like wind purely on economics. Do you agree with that?
No. I think when we match strategists with the other tools, the ProSim runs, the ProMods, the other things that we do, I think we capture the cost and impacts of the deficiencies that strategist has. We understand what those are, and I think we capture those costs.
So you don't have any problem making this purely on economics? Are there other factors we should be considering?
No, because I think to a large degree it is an economic consideration.
Okay. All right. And then on this chart that we've referenced a couple times, mm-hmm. you were talking to Commissioner Christman a bit about this. The gas that, and he was talking about combustion turbines, I think. And I was curious if some of this isn't also combined cycle.
It is a combination.
Is it a lot of that? Are we seeing a fair amount of, because the combined cycle would be running, you know, at the times that he was referencing in the middle of the night when it's not, mm-hmm. It's not just the peakers that you're backing off. So.
And I would have to go back and look exactly the breakdown. Strategists would report to us exactly which unit mm-hmm. it comes from. A lot of it's going to be combined cycle. One way that I test that, you know, you look at diagnostics, heat rate is a diagnostic. It kind of tells you the conversion from one fuel to energy. A typical combined cycle is a 7 heat rate. A CT is a 10 heat rate. When I look at the average displaced wind, it's displacing about a 6 heat rate. So that's the impact of some of the coal, but it also gives me an indication that it's a lot of the hours at the combined cycle level
mm-hmm.
because it's not above a combined cycle.
Right.
If you look at solar on the flip side, you actually have it where it's displacing more of more CT hours, so because it's an on-peak resource.
Okay. Let me buzz through. I think I just have one left. Oh, let's talk a little bit about the gas, the potential gas plant in North Dakota and the Hankinson project. In Wishart's testimony, he said that this decision could affect the case for that gas plant. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Do you want me to find that?
Yeah, I thought he said he didn't.
It could affect
the energy.
The choice.
It could affect the energy because you have a combined cycle. Calpine's alternative is a combined cycle. And so from the standpoint that this is an energy resource, it could potentially devalue Calpine as another energy resource, because theirs is a CC.
Mm-hmm.
It won't impact CTs because they're really capacity resources.
Okay.
So that's what Steve was talking about in his testimony, is there could be a potential impact on another energy type resource, which is Calpine. But from a CT, the capacity we're talking for wind starts in 2021. The capacity that we're talking about looking at now for the CTs is in 17 to 19.
Okay, so you'd still be looking to fill that capacity, which this doesn't do.
Correct.
Okay. Let's see here. There's one other question. Oh, I've talked about both of those. Let's see here. So, back to the cocktail party. And you've got a lot of experience, 31 years, and you've worked a lot in gas, so you've seen years of sort of stability and now lots of change. I'm interested in hearing from you any concerns that you have. What are your concerns over this transition from kind of the tried-and-true fuel of coal to fluctuating resource like wind backed up with fuel that also a commodity like gas that fluctuates a lot. What concerns you about that?
Well, one, I think you have to do it in a way that you can phase in and phase out. And I think that the way that we've put together our plans for Xcel is that we are phasing in and we're not doing, you know, 2,000 megawatts at a time. We are taking steps to go ahead and dollar cost average, bring it in to make sure it can be operated reliably, things like that. So I think that's one of the things that I get concerned with. Too drastic of a change, too quick, and can you handle it? I think the other thing is, what are the economics of the future world going to look like? If we would have had this discussion back in 2008, 2009, I think if anybody would have come in and said they wanted to build a lot of natural gas plants, they would have been laughed out of the room. The United States was on a treadmill. They couldn't keep up with production. they were looking at importing LNG from places like the Middle East at $13 a decatherm. That's what was setting the expectations. Our world has changed dramatically with the shale gas now, not only on the oil front, but on the natural gas front. I think what we have to do is have a plan that maintains balance, but that transitions as opportunities come available. And I think that's what we really tried to do. I did look at the resource mix in for NSP in 2020 over lunch. You know, we're about a third coal, about 20% nuke. You know, we're going to be about 23% renewable, and then the rest gas. That's a pretty comfortable mix in my mind, realizing the coal price is to some degree fixed, has historically been a low escalator. The nuclear price is to some degree fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The wind, for the most part, has a fixed escalator, and we've got a little bit of exposure in the gas piece, but it's not huge. And the question is to manage that balance going forward. And as Commissioner Crisman asked, what do you think about long term? I think those are the things that we'll continue to make a little decision, a little decision, a little decision, and watch to see how they start to add up and be able to move and migrate that as we make those incremental decisions. Although we look at these wind contracts as 20 years as a long time, in the planning world, they'll go by pretty quickly. We will have another bite at this apple to look at in just about another 10 years, because we'll start looking at the retirement of these facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, there is an impact period, but these facilities aren't 60-year assets. They are only about 20 to 25-year assets, depending upon ownership versus PPA. So we do get the time to migrate, and not it's not falling off the cliff.
Okay. And then one last more specific question in the Minnesota Chamber's testimony, they talked about the life cycle of the plants in Europe not meeting the expectations. And so, first of all, curious if you agree or disagree on that. And then secondly, how would that change the affordability of this? Would any, if there's problems with these turbines and the life cycle is shorter, is there any risk of that coming back to the ratepayers, or is that going to fall on the lap of the people you're buying the power from?
Under purchase power arrangements, it falls in the lap of the people we're buying it from. Under ownership, it's an issue that we have to deal with. And that's what the department or the Chamber of Commerce wants to talk to us about. We've agreed, and Laura committed, that we would have the same discussion up here.
Yep.
About what type of commitment we could make on the ownership costs and operation to make sure that there's some comfort there.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions from the commission?
A couple, Your Honor.
Chairman Kolk.
You okay to keep rolling,
can
Kurt?
I'm going to go trick-or-treating now.
Soon.
And, Kurt, I really appreciate your, like Julie pointed out, your knowledge and insight. It's always helpful to be able to have the back and forth, and I appreciate it. Appreciate your experience and your work with Xcel and the quandary that you face sitting in the chair you're in trying to develop resource plans with all these different jurisdictions. One thing that I was going to ask you about is my understanding. Let me just go through the systems. The Minot system is basically landlocked, surrounded by Vendry Electric. We purchased the power there from – Xcel purchased the power from somewhere else to serve Minot's load. Grand Forks is basically landlocked, surrounded by Nodak Electric. And Fargo is basically landlocked, surrounded by Cass County Electric. I don't know any growth areas land-wise in North Dakota. Is that correct? That's the way I understand the system.
You know, I don't have a great history of exactly delivery to those. My understanding is that we have transmission arrangements allow us to swap out power or have power delivered to those areas.
But I'm
so
getting
we don't have exact purchase contracts for them, but we have delivery arrangements.
What I'm getting at is the I know that my daughter's now in college, but when she was at home, you had every year she got older, she used more energy, the curling iron to the iPad. So you've got your individual houses are, and if I had a son, he'd probably be using more too, I'm sure. So, but the point is that the average consumer is using more energy. I get that, right? But how do I explain to my favorite analogy, the guy in the Senate station, that North Dakota's demand is not really growing that much, but Xcel's footprint is growing a lot, or their energy demands as a system are needing more eventually? How do we relate that to the North Dakota customer that's going to have to pay more for the need that's required by the whole integrated system, even though our percentage is so very small in our growth, in our footprint?
And actually, in total, we're not growing very much. And there's a number of reasons why the systems aren't growing. You know, the flat screen TVs use 5% of the 10% of the energy that the old TVs did. The light bulbs, obviously the standard, you don't use as much. There's so many things in the appliance worlds now that don't. Most people don't have desktops anymore. They don't have the big monitors. They have iPads. They have, you know, charge-in devices that don't take as much energy. So we're not seeing the growth in energy either.
But your projected growth is
small.
Very small.
Almost flat. And so really that's...
Is that in the record somewhere that your projected growth is that small? Because you always hear all the anecdotal information that even though you have all these devices, we're still growing energy demands throughout the country. So is that something that you have in there?
I believe we filed a copy of the resource plan with you folks.
You did, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's in there. It's in there as an exhibit. So you could see the projected growth.
Okay.
So it is relatively flat. And so, you know, really some of the costs that you're hearing about are obviously the transmission that MISO and the projects to enhance reliability and carry out the charge that MISO has been given. You know, some of those costs, and I'm walking very close to the line of my knowledge, you know, includes the Monticello uprate and life extension, so we keep that in the mix. I mean, certainly those aren't necessarily to do with growth. It's kind of replacing
right. And
meeting reliability.
Okay, you kind of walked into my next question. I appreciate that, clearing that up about the growth projections for Xcel, because, you know, in North Dakota, we're short power, 2,000 megawatts in the west, so we've got a whole different load shape in the western part of the state. But I was thinking about the nuke plant, and with those uprates, what's the life expectancy of the nuke plant now? We're out there in our 30 years?
The life extension was for 20 years.
Okay, so if you didn't have that baseload nuclear, I mean, that's a huge anchor tenant for you guys. Mm-hmm. And as you phase into what's going to happen with that, what time frame do you have to start really getting serious about the base load replacement?
You know, we're already contemplating and starting to have some of those discussions internally. It will show up probably in the resource plan in probably 5 to 7 years, I'm guessing.
Okay.
But to the extent that we would actually contemplate a third relicensing, if that's in the cards, which some of the nuclear plants are looking at doing,
that would be the best for everyone if that would somehow become a possibility, I suppose.
And we'd just have to see what the costs are.
I was just trying to, the whole ADP discussion I had with Laura this morning was, when I view ADP, I view it as you're going to build back to that 500 megawatt coal plant or that 500 megawatt gas plant, something that's a whole bunch of money. It's a big risk. You come in front of the commission, you make your case, the commission grants ADP because it's a significant outlay of money. When you look at this 750 megawatts, what's your total megawatts in your integrated system right now?
Again, we're roughly a 9,500 megawatt system.
Okay, so we figure 9,500 megawatts, and this is 750 of that. So this isn't even 1% of it yet. Not even.
It'd be 10%.
10%? Yeah, my 10%. Number's off?
Yeah, yeah. 9, get rid of 0.
All right, 10%. Okay. Thank you for that. I guess the question, though, I still about the whole advanced determination of prudence, that's not something you're worried about so much. You're worried about meeting the demands. How do you view demand-side management as an overall tool to meet your energy needs?
Well, certainly it's been a tool that's been widely used.
But is it more of a feel-good thing, or does it actually really help things?
No, it actually reduces energy and capacity, and we see that across on all of our systems.
Is there some way that the number of megawatts you'd have from demand-side management that you can aggregate that to?
Yeah, certainly. I think when we look at the Minnesota system, the demand-side management program has saved approximately a capacity, I think, of about 1,500 megawatts.
Okay, and when you say Minnesota, is that because you don't track North Dakota, or we don't have a very aggressive?
I shouldn't do this. I use Minnesota because jargon for NSP.
Sure.
NSP is what I'm saying is in general, in total, it's about 1,500 megawatts for the NSP system. I typically call my systems Texas, Colorado, and Minnesota. So
no, that's fine. I just wanted to double check that. Okay, is that something that this commission should look at? Allocating monies for XL to improve its demand-side management program?
I mean, I'm certainly, that is one of the areas that a lot of people, a lot of states, have looked at and continue to encourage. I know that's a source of debate in a number of the states that we deal with. So I think it is something that you can certainly put on the radar screen, and we'd be more than happy to come up and talk to you about what is.
That was in a previous rate case that I was part of that commission, but a different mix of the. We basically said no on it, but I've been rethinking that several different times of how that would, we can make the argument that that benefits all the customers, and I think you can by offsetting generation, that maybe we should look at that going down the road. But where does that weigh out in all this resource planning? How do you pull that mix in there and say, okay, instead of adding this, I should spend more time on demand-side management?
You know, that's actually one of the points that is being debated around the country. We typically have done the situation where a DSM, demand-side management docket, results feed into a resource plan, and then the resource plan helps educate the demand-side docket, the next one, about what are the costs avoided, and it kind of goes back and forth.
Okay.
There's been a lot of discussion, should these somehow be merged together more closely? It gets really to be a big case if we do that,
right.
But I think as more and more choices come up and more sophisticated questions are answered, I could see that overlap starting to occur more.
Especially if the wind prices go negative and you can have a way to have off-peak heating or off-peak water or something that you then no longer have that negative pricing on wind.
And that's really the carrot that's put out to people is there a way to go ahead and do, they have like what they call ice storage, where they actually make ice at night during those periods and bring it back and use it during the day. So those are the innovative ways that people could look at it, but I do believe that they will start to be integrated more and more over time.
Perfect. And the last one, I just have a question. I appreciate Julie's question, which I think clarified my mind about the North Dakota customers aren't getting the energy free. From the $85,000 is an offset of cost. It's not, I misunderstood that. So thank you, Julie, for asking that question. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the commission? Commissioner Christman.
If strategist said that the costs were exactly equal, which would provide the most reliability for the region, 750 megawatts of combined cycle gas or 750 megawatts of wind?
Okay, there's always a caveat in that. From an operational standpoint, I'd like gas. How does that weigh against a future carbon risk that I don't know that natural gas would have? It'd be the offset. So if I did straight up break even today, no carbon, then I have to weigh the operational versus the future carbon risk. If you don't believe future carbon risk, it's gas.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the commission?
Your Honor, I forgot one.
Last time around.
Yeah. Were you part at all with the asset that you're going to own, potentially, the Border Winds and the other one? How do you figure decommissioning costs for those wind farms? That's become a very hot topic of debate. Is that anywhere in your cost for this wind farm?
You know, typically the decommissioning for a owned asset, I think there's a decommissioning reserve that's established through the revenue requirements, but I would have to check.
Since you're an investor-owned, you can handle it differently than a one somebody would send it into the merchant.
Yeah, and again, if I remember correct how it's modeled in Strategist, then I'd have to go back and check. I think there is a decommissioning fund that's established as a part of the regulated asset.
Okay, thank
over
you.
Over time. But I'd have to check.
I think that sounds right. Thank you.
Is that something you would like filed late as
no,
something that they can file?
I think once the witness refreshed my memory of investor-owned utilities decommissioning plans, I understand it again.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. At this time, we'll go to the company. Ms. Valley, do you have any questions?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, Commissioners. I did want to make one clarification. Chair Kolk, you had talked about the sales forecast. We do have a sales forecast in the pending rate case, if you wanted more information about that.
Refresh my memory again about the question I asked.
You were asking about the rate of growth in our North Dakota jurisdiction, and so that information is detailed in the rate case.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Hager. I just wanted to clarify a few points that have come up today. We've been talking about different percentages about in terms of renewables and where we are today and what we're adding. And I believe, just to clarify, you had stated in response to what our resource mix is that our current amount of renewables on the system is about 20%. Is that correct?
I was talking about a 2020 look,
okay.
Not today.
And with respect to the Prairie Rose costs, you've clarified for the commission what that current $85,000 figure represents. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, could you explain how that calculation, I guess what the significance of that calculation is in the future and how maybe that might change?
Well, obviously if the average or the cost of the replacement energy would go higher relative to the Prairie Rose, then it might flip around to the standpoint that it's not a credit to North Dakota customers, but it could actually be a cost to North Dakota customers.
Thank you. And we've talked a lot today about capacity resources, energy resources for this particular facility. I'm wondering if you could just give a short primer on the difference and how to conceptualize the difference between capacity and energy resources.
Well, again, the capacity resource is that resource that's in the ground to make peak day, to be available on peak day, and also is the backbone of the reliability of the system. CTs, CCs, coal, those are the plants that you're going to operate on peak day and you have control over. Once you get past planning your system from a capacity standpoint, then you really get to planning it on an energy standpoint, and then it's a question of which energy resource do you use to serve what load every minute of every day, every hour? And so that's where the energy planning comes from. So it becomes somewhat secondary to the capacity planning. And that's where wind has the opportunity to displace other fuels, is in that energy side of the world. We've already got the system constructed to meet peak day. We know we've got reliability covered from peak day. It's then just managing the fuel and energy dispatch every minute, every hour.
And can you clarify what you mean by peak day?
Again, what I'm talking about peak day is whenever the system's at its highest, regardless if it's in the winter or if it's highest in the summer. You know, we have a winter peak day, we have a summer peak day. Both of those come into play. Both of those are reliability issues that we have to make sure we have adequate resources to go ahead and be available on those days.
And can you just also give a summary of marginal cost dispatch and how that works?
Marginal cost is basically looking at what's the last unit on, the next unit that will come on, on exactly how you look at avoided cost or marginal cost. But it's really that next cost of that unit and what is going to be that. That would be setting, like we talk about local or local marginal pricing, LMP. That's what it's attempting to do, is say, what is that next set of energy going to cost, that next piece of energy, and that's at marginal price.
And Mr. Hager, are those the costs that are in the fuel clause?
No, the actual costs would be in the fuel clause. So now I got to be a little bit careful here because you have two different things happening. You have your transaction with MISO and what our costs of our system. So to the extent that we bid in our load and they bid in the generation, and whatever the clearing price at MISO is what we get paid for generation, what we pay for our load, then that offsets our actual fuel prices. So there is a component there that kind of makes it a little more difficult when you're in MISO than what the old traditional utility, where it was just whatever the cost of your own generation was, because you're actively participating in this buy-sell market every day.
And in comparison, our capacity resources are generally in base rates, the capacity cost.
Yeah, they're generally either in base rates through ownership or through purchase power agreements where we pay a demand charge.
We've talked a lot about resource planning in general, these different concepts that apply, but getting back to these projects, the ones that are in front of us today, are these additions to our system or the XL Energy system cost effective?
Yes.
And does the addition of these plants reduce costs for customers over the life of the projects?
We do project that they will reduce cost to customers over the full 20 to 25 year life.
And does that analysis account for the fact that those resources will displace coal and natural gas that are currently on the system?
Yes, it takes account fully that they would displace those resources, and in addition to the costs of integration and all of the other ancillary services that we need to take into account to bring the wind on.
And you'd also mentioned that MISO had done a study, you know, looking at quadrupling the addition of wind resource on the MISO system. Is it your understanding that the transmission system is capable of having these facilities integrated in the time frame proposed?
Yes, and again, MISO will clarify that when they finish up their studies that they're doing for the interconnection requests. And so we always have a little bit of concern until we see exactly any additions that would be added. But what we're talking about, to give you an idea, I think one estimate for the Borders project is like $26 million. So they're not multi-hundred millions of dollars of issues. They're, you know, tens of millions of dollars.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hager.
Mr. Norrell, do you have any further questions?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong?
Mr. Hager, the decommissioning cost, that would just be involving the Pleasant Valley and Border Winds, is that correct?
That would be correct.
What would it take to confirm that those were included in your strategist modeling?
We could, you know, give you some response. I would have to go find the model.
Is that something you could do over a break, or is that something that's going to take a day or so?
I don't know if the person I need to talk to is there this afternoon. But I could certainly get it by tomorrow.
We can address that at the end of the hearing then. Nothing further.
Anything further from the commission?
I have a follow-up if I could.
Commissioner Kalk?
Follow-up to your question, I guess. Could you walk me through again? You talk about the peak. So how do you measure the peak? Just the peak day, but is it by system? Is it by state? How do you measure different peaks?
Since we designed the NSP system in total, we'd look at the peak of the NSP system in total, and it's by month, and so that we would have peak information for, like, July and also the peak winter months.
So if you measure it monthly, so you have 12 different times a year you get your peaks, then is that weighted by different states as you build your resources mix, or is it just you plan to meet that one big peak, whether it occurs in whether the driver is any particular state?
We look at a coincident peak when we look at our system. So coincident peak on that hour, whenever it is in July, or let's say December peak. So we would look at what the peak is in the system in total. So it's not weighted by state. It's whatever it is across the whole operating company.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
So I've been trying for the last few days to think of an analogy, like a simple analogy. And I haven't come up with one. I've tried, like, groceries and shoes and, you know, like, so I have the nearest thing I can come up with to explain what this is equivalent to is this. So you let me know if I'm off, where I'm off. And it's all really close to what we're talking about. So what you are suggesting here is similar to if we were go to the gas station with our car and look at the various fuel mixes and the price. If we saw one that was really cheap, we'd fill up that car and every other car we have, even if we didn't need it, and maybe we'd store some gas too and try to get a bunch of that really low-cost gas on hand to use, knowing that down the road we're going to need it, even though we don't need it right now. Is that a fair analogy? Stop laughing, my diller.
Have you been thinking about that too? No. Yeah, I mean, obviously I get worried about all sorts of different analogies to say. What I'm hearing is you're saying is, okay, you go to a station and you have the ability to sign a long-term contract with that filling station.
Mm-hmm.
You got a Conoco on one, got a Shell on the other. You walk into the guy that's selling Shell, and he says, you know, if you make a long-term commitment to me, I'm going to guarantee you that I'll sell you gas at $2.50 for the next 25 years. Go across to the guy at Conoco and says, well, my forecast is $2.75. But it could go lower. Could bounce around. Could go higher. I'm not going to make a deal with you. I'll let you ride. You go home and you think, okay, am I comfortable with the $2.50 for the long term based upon my budget today? Or do I want to go ahead and ride the market?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the distinction that we have right now.
Okay.
We're kind of saying it's the same product. It's going to get us the same amount of energy. We've already taken into account the idea of balancing the reliability issues because of the way we do our analysis. And the question is, are you comfortable with a long-term agreement? And that's where I come back to look at my history of natural gas prices and where we are and saying, I'm signing this at a rock-bottom low price. Yeah, if gas prices were at $7, I'd be more worried about the gas prices falling. But the equivalents of these are already in that lower tranche of potential gas prices. Even when we test it like Sarah did at a lower price, it's still break even or better. And so that's really what I think we have to say is, as a part of a portfolio, does it make sense to have energy locked in for customers at this low price? And that's why we want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do this for RPS. We didn't do it for anything else. We did it for the fact that we have not seen these kind of low prices, and we think it is kind of a one-of-a-time situation.
Thank you.
All right, any further questions from anyone for this witness? Randy's not even looking this direction. Thank you, Mr. Hager. You're excused. Ms. Valley, does that comprise the NSP testimony?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. It's 3 o'clock. We are going to take a break in just a moment, but, counsel, let's do a little math here. I understand, are you going to have Ms. Cardwell testify? And Mr. Diller?
Just Ms. Cardwell, Your Honor.
Just Ms. Cardwell. So what do you expect for direct questioning?
5 minutes.
Okay. And Ms. Valley or Mr. Simpson?
We have one prepared direct question, Your Honor.
So we may be able to finish today.
Oh, today, sure.
Okay. All right. Then we will take a 10-minute recess. Make it 15. Scott, are we off?
Good, I can go see my trick or treat.
Not yet?
Yeah.
Don't tell me what it is.
The rest of the analogy is, though?
What? Yeah.